This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, a conversation with Bob Boylan, creator and host of NPR's All Songs Considered. First up, the Over the Rhine Museum, which is currently in its planning and development stage, is modeled on the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City. The founder of the Tenement Museum, Ruth Abram, is in Cincinnati to give a presentation at a sold-out event tonight at the Mercantile Library. She also founded the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and the National Women's Agenda and Coalition. In 2014, she founded Behold New Lebanon, the nation's first living museum of contemporary rural American life. Historian and preservationist Ruth Abram joins us to discuss her life and her work, and you can be part of the discussion at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ruth, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ruth, what got you interested in preservation?
Well, you know, I'm actually interested in the preservation of memory more than buildings. But yet you need buildings often in order to preserve memory. And with regard to the Tenement Museum, the fact is that since 1920, we have been an urban nation. That is, more of us have come and lived in the cities than on the farms or in the countryside. And yet, while our rural past has certainly been memorialized and honored, there are log cabins and small farmhouses preserved all over this country. There had not been, until the creation of the Tenement Museum, even one example of the type of housing millions had known as their first home in America. And I didn't feel that was appropriate, because the fact is that when you ignore a widely shared cultural memory, which this kind of living situation certainly was, you suggest that neither the people who lived it nor the memory is worthy of inclusion in the historical record. And if you're not worthy of inclusion in the historical record, you're nobody. And we really can't let that stand, because it's not true, and second, because so many people are repeating that experience today.
You say you're more concerned about preserving memories. How tough is it to do that?
Well, let me back up and say a little bit about what the Tenement Museum is, because there are lots of ways to preserve memory. But this building was built in 1863 by a German-born immigrant who was a tailor on a lot that was 68 wide by 88 deep. He had six floors, four apartments per floor, 325 square feet each, no indoor plumbing, no lighting, no ventilation. It was good enough for this man, Lucas Glockner, because he moved right in himself. And given what was also available in New York for working class immigrants, this was fantastic. And he really put his soul into it. It's an Italianate building. It's pretty on the outside with all kinds of wonderful decorative work. It's made of solid brick. Look, it's lasted very well all this time and now has thousands of visitors, hundreds of thousands of visitors coming through. And the first people who came in were primarily German immigrants like himself, working class people. And then over time, it finally closed in 1935. Just in the Great Depression, and by that time it had really deteriorated, and it was home to the poorest of poor. And we tell the story of the entire history of the building through actual families who really did live there in the apartments where they lived. And our scholars think that as many as 7,000 people moved into that building, called it home, from over 20 nations. So our quest was, who are we going to choose? How are we going to decide? What are we trying to do here? And let's just start with what the mission of the museum is, which is admittedly unusual for a museum. It is not to preserve a building. It is not to preserve artifacts. It is to promote tolerance and historical perspective through the presentation and interpretation of the variety of immigrant experiences. So that's what we started out to do. So to do that, we need to make it clear that many different kinds of people lived in this building.
7,000 people.
Yeah. We actually found the names. We're able to document 1,300. But in the tenements, it was very common for people to stay just 1 year, because on May 1st, landlords gave 1 month's free rent to anyone who came. So you might move right across the street, and that's how the numbers soar.
So you talk about this is a museum about preserving memories, preserving history, but undoubtedly it's got a lot of items and artifacts in it.
It does.
What kinds of things are in the museum?
Well, when you go in, you're led by a tour guide, and this guide is going to tell you the story of the building and the particular family that lived in the apartment that you are going to see. So the stage is set. So, for instance, in the German apartment, the Gumperts apartment, Julius Gumperts was a shoemaker. And in 1873, in the midst of the Great Depression, when one quarter of the working people in New York were out of work, he got up from his table in the kitchen, which you could see, and goes to his place of work, which is downtown. And according to court records, he never returned. And his wife and family looked everywhere for him. Now, we've got a family now with three children, a Great Depression, a woman left with three children. And what she does to save herself is to become a seamstress. But Natalie Gumperts is the first deserted woman and the first single mom ever presented in a National Historic Site. So right there you have a dramatic story. You have a German-Jewish family. You have the story of the Great Depression, of the shoe industry. And the people who come add their own stories that relate to the story of Natalie Gumperts. Some of them have been deserted. Some of them are single moms. Some of them have lived through great depressions. So everybody joins in.
How do you find all the detailed information about the families who lived in that particular building? And then how long did it take you to amass all that before you could open the museum?
Well, it took a long time to open this museum, and patience is the name of the game. We found it and had to wait 5 years to convince the landlord to sell it to us. So for 5 years, we simply ran from a storefront walking tours and a play that I wrote based on the life of one immigrant family. And that's how we got attention to the building. Finally, the landlord was willing to sell it, and then we had the problem of convincing anybody that it was a good idea. Lots of opposition. In the first instance was the place. It was in the Lower East Side, which in the 1980s was drug-infested, crime-infested, filthy, and miserable. And people said, no one will come just because of where it is. But we said, that's where the tenement started. So we've got to put it here. That's just the way it is. So we persevered. Then the preservation community, the leadership, some of the leaders in it said, this tenement has no redeeming architectural value. No one of importance ever lived there, and there are thousands of them. And we said, that's right. That's the story we're going to tell. And one of the great historians of the tenement experience, Irving Howe, refused to sign on as an advisor, saying we were going to engrandize and prettify poverty. So we had opposition from places we hadn't expected. So 5 years of trying to get the thing. And then the building was in terrible condition. So people thought, what? And then they'd never heard of a tenement museum. And talking about working class poor people. Well, who does that? Historic houses are for the rich and famous. So we had a lot of uphill fight, but it was worth it.
Well, they said nobody would come. Have you proven them wrong?
It's the most visited historic site in Manhattan.
Right. How many have come through, do you know?
Well, altogether, there's 300,000 a year right now.
Wow.
Yeah, and we'll be more because we have to turn people away still.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, 300,000 people, so you're getting a lot of reaction to this. What are people telling you about what they're seeing and hearing from this museum?
Well, one of the first things we had to do was to teach our docents what to do when people cried. People are very moved because they find themselves and their family story honored for the first time. Another group who gets very excited about it are immigrants themselves, who had no idea that in America we would honor a working class and poor immigrant experience in this very visceral way, and they feel they're being honored. So that's very exciting. And this is another aspect of the museum. We didn't just ask, what is the history? And I'll come back to your question about how you get the history. But also, what can history do to improve the world? And so when we saw the response of immigrant visitors, how moved they were, how excited they were, how much they wanted to talk about their own experience and compare and contrast it to what was going on in Natalie Gumpert's or the Levine apartment or the Baldizi apartment. We went out into our neighborhood and found that immigrants were waiting up to 3 years for free English classes. We said we could do that, and we opened English classes, and they loved it because they wanted to tell their stories. They have great motivation to speak English and to do it in a narrative way. Very exciting. So how do you find the stories? We had a superb genealogist who traced families and went all the way back and gathered all the records, whether they were charitable records, divorce records, desertion records, church records, synagogue records, and began to piece the story together, quite a number of stories. And then we looked for three things. We looked for how together they would tell the whole story of the tenement building, the life of the tenement, and the variety of people in it. How dramatic was the story, because we wanted people's hearts. How normal was the story for immigrants. We didn't want to do outliers. And finally, how important was this story as a tool for raising contemporary issues? I'll give you an example of the lengths to which we went. One of the families we interpret are as a family, the Rogoszewski family from Poland, and they were in the sweatshops after the sweatshop moved from the tenement building to the factories as a result of the reform movement. And every apartment is interpreted at a particular time in the family's life. So you walk into a moment in their lives. And this apartment is interpreted at the death of the father. And the family is sitting Shiva, the Jewish mourning custom. On the table are the round foods that are set, representing the circle of life. And we explain about the whole custom of Shiva and how this worked, and also what this man did and what happened to his wife, left with 8 children. So we also, our genealogists, traced all 8 children and to the grandchildren and to the great-grandchildren, and we invited them all back to the museum to meet their forebears. And they came, and some were wearing black yarmulkes, men, which let us know that this was an Orthodox Jew. A woman came who was a rabbi, and then quite a lot of people came with no indication at all. We brought in the head of the Jewish Burial Society, and he was there to help us elicit from all of these people any family memories of this death and this Shiva and this family.
And that's how you're able to get so much detail into these stories.
Yes. But then one young woman raised her hand and said to the head of the Hebrew Burial Society, very annoyed, "This museum seems to think my great-grandparents were very religious, but we have no reason to think that." And he said, "Well, I'm sure the museum won't interpret them as religious and observant if they weren't, right?" I said, "Right." So we're talking, and all of a sudden, he says to everybody in the room, "Anyone here pre-tear their toilet paper?" Big shock, because the New York Times is there reporting on this, and I'm thinking, what are we going to get into here? And all kinds of people raise their hands from all different parts of the family. "Why do you do it?" he asked the young one. "I don't know. My parents did it." "Why do you do it?" he said to another. "I don't know. My grandparents did it." On and on. Nobody knew why they did it. They all did it. And he said, "Orthodox, very Orthodox observant Jews don't work on the Sabbath, and they regard tearing toilet paper as work, so they pre-tear it. You come from a very religious family." So we went to every extreme, it's very, very important to tell the truth as much as we can.
We will continue our conversation with Ruth Abram and take your phone calls. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon, the founder of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City, historian and preservationist Ruth Abram. She's in Cincinnati to give a presentation at a sold-out event tonight at the Mercantile Library. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Malcolm in Mount Adams joins us now. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi there. I was in the museum when it first opened here. The office was on the corner in a tiny little storefront. You just finished with the first building.
Right.
And it was fascinating. The thing that you had was really interesting to me was I asked about all these other buildings on the block. They're all boarded up.
Yes.
And they told me, first of all, I had learned that there were outhouses at the time. Even at the time that the tenements stopped being tenements, and the city had required, New York City had required certain plumbing advances, and the landlords weren't willing to make them, and those buildings got boarded up, and they were still boarded up at this time. When was it? The 70s?
Yeah. Well, we came in the 90s, but you know, Malcolm, the interesting thing about the privies, and you're so right, that was the outdoor toilets in the courtyards, was that the main opposition didn't come from the landlords in 1905. It came from the tenants, who were horrified with the idea of bringing bathrooms inside. They thought that was disgusting.
Malcolm, thank you so much for the phone call. We appreciate it. Let's talk with Scott in College Hill. Hi, Scott. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call. I lived in New York for about 5 years, and whenever visitors came, usually from Cincinnati, I would always take them to the Tenement Museum. It was fascinating. I probably went 4 or 5 times in that period, and I learned something every time, and I highly recommend it. It's like you're stepping back in time, but it's awesome. So nice hearing you, Ruth.
Thank you so much.
Scott, thank you for the phone call. We appreciate it. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk with Robert in Blue Ash. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Thanks, Mark. I really enjoy your guest. I had a question about modern structures like Cabrini Green in Chicago, whether it's possible that projects like that will ever have some historic value, there'd be a museum dedicated to that, and whether there needs to be a threshold of aesthetic to make something appealing historically, and also whether the demographic is important, whether there are family ties. Our society is so mobile and fragmented now. Is it because of this that we are long to have a time when people did gather more in the houses they lived in or even the tenements they lived in?
Well, you know, you came from Cincinnati to New York to see the Tenement Museum. That was good news, and lots of people do from all over the world. There is an effort underway, a wonderful effort to preserve and interpret the Jane Addams Public Housing Project, which is empty and which will tell the story of public housing, and I wish it so, so well. I've advised it a bit. And as for people coming together, you know, we have met the descendants of many of the people whose stories we tell, and even some of the people whose stories we tell who were children at the time in the 30s. And every single one of them feels that when they left and went to, I don't know, Long Island or the suburbs or wherever they went, they never again felt the community feeling that they had in the tenements, and at the same time, they would never, ever want their children to live there. So we've got both things. Mark had asked a question about what you see there, and now I've heard from two of you who've been there, but you remember there are no signs on the walls, no text on the walls, no ropes to keep you from being connected to the space and the furnishings, because we wanted to invite Americans home to meet their families before they were acceptable, before they had the money, before they had the language or the customs of the country. And the intent was to ring a bell in the minds of the visitor and make them think about their own immigrant forebears for whom they have, with whom they have a great deal of pride, in whom they, and tell their children about it, as, and they are heroes to them. And we wanted to say that the people on the streets today, who are the newcomers today, are standing in the same shoes as the immigrant ancestors they so admire. And that was a big objective of the Tenement Museum and remains an objective. Did you feel that when you were there?
So, Ruth, you've got several other projects going, though.
And yes,
let's talk about those. The International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, what's that project about?
Well, you know, I was 10 years into building the Tenement Museum and was still having terrible trouble raising money for all the reasons I've just described, and also because we were doing things like having English lessons for immigrants, like teaching children to inspect their own tenements for violations of the housing code, and museums that funded, foundations that funded museums said, well, that's really a settlement house's job. That's not a museum. And those who funded social change said, well, museums are peripheral to the main business of social change. So neither of them could grapple with this. So I decided to try to demonstrate that I wasn't alone. I hoped I wasn't. I was getting lonely. And I wrote a letter to 100 national sites around the world asking who out there sees history as I do, who sees it as a goad for social change. And only 8 replied. But
you didn't feel quite as lonely, though, anymore.
No, 8 is better than none. And I got a, because there were such amazing sites, the Gulag Museum in Russia, which is the Stalinist labor camp, the workhouse in England for the abject poor in the 19th century, the Manzanar, the Japanese internment camp or American internment camp for Japanese, on and on. I took this list to Rockefeller and said, look, we need to talk, these people and I. And they gave us a grant to go to their conference center in Bellagio. And we went, and as we sat around the table, talked about what we were doing, we were shocked because it turned out that not one of us, including myself, had come from the museum field. We had all come except for the one person.
But you were all headed down this in the same direction.
But we were all building museums in order to in order to excite people about the present and telling them the story of the past, seeing to help them connect with the present. So the workhouse in England didn't just want to show people how Britain dealt with abject poverty in the 19th century. It wanted to ask them, how should we be dealing with it today? The Tenement Museum didn't want to just show people what immigrants lived in. We wanted to talk about immigration to America and what we think about it. So that was true of all of them. And we realized that we were the beginning of a new movement for museums.
So eight. How it's gotten bigger since then?
Yes. So the International Coalition was formed in that meeting. And we signed a great document saying that dialogue was the center of our work, public dialogue, to connecting the past with the present. And that the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience now has 200 operating museums around the world, 55 countries represented. And they're all embracing dialogue as an important part of their visitor experience.
Now, Behold New Lebanon, that's the other project. This one fascinates me. Tell me about this. Describe this to me.
Well, about 8 years ago, I moved to a tiny 2,300-person town, a little town on the border of Massachusetts and New York. And I watched in horror as first the only pizza joint closed, and then a little gift store closed, and then the grocery store closed. And I thought, what have I come to? And I since I'm a historian, I went to the library to figure out what to do. What had this place been? And discovered it was once in the center of the world. It was the center of natural healing. And it had these fantastic springs, and it had a whole hydrotherapy clinic, and it created this huge number of rare herbs that were sent around the world. It was the first pharmaceutical factory in America there. What had happened to make it decline? And I decided that by then I'd met a lot of people there, and I went around town saying, I think we need to do what the people who were successful before us did. Just use the resources that we have. Not wait for some factory to come and save the town or some store. No, it's us. And so I asked people, what do you know about or know how to do that that city and urban and suburban people don't know? And their answers filled 8 pages. I know how to breed heritage cows. My wife and I are homesteaders. I can make quince jam. On and on they went. I race cars. And I then asked them if they would teach what they know. And so this museum is made up of over 40 people in this tiny little town who are teaching.
Which is in New York?
New York.
Okay.
What they know. And people are coming from all over the place to go and spend some time with them.
Yeah, so it's a museum it's a museum without walls.
No,
it's an actual
walls.
Living museum.
Yes, and it's different in many ways. There's no you don't go to the museum. You go to a building and you get on a bus and you get taken to people's homes and their kitchens and their forests and their fields, and they teach you what you want to know.
Ruth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The founder of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City, historian and preservationist Ruth Abram. Coming up, we'll talk with Bob Boylan, creator and host of All Songs Considered, and we'll hear about the Tiny Desk Concert Contest. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.